Yeah.
All right. So we have with us Miss Nicole Chobin.
Hello.
I want to welcome you to the first, you are our first guest for Anchored Souls Uncut. So thank you for being here.
I am humbled, honored, happy, and like ready to do the happy dance jigs. Couldn't be happier to be here.
So I ask you to be on our podcast simply because you had an amazing story that you shared with me. Gosh, I feel like it's been forever ago because we've talked so much, but I want you to share your story with the world. And, you know, really, you know, Anchored Souls, anybody that has not heard about Anchored Souls, we're really talking about the tough stuff and the things that people don't want to talk about and how we survive adversity and the different adversities that we face on a day-to-day basis. And everybody has a different story. So I'm going to open it up to you, Nicole, to really just share your story and the bits and pieces that you feel are pertinent and that are going to help, you know, that's going to help people out there.
Okay. I'm a firm believer in adversity to empowerment. Because it's a big leap, but it's an amazing journey. And I'm not going to say it's an easy one. It is one of the hardest things that will happen to you in life. And it can really suck sometimes. And I don't care who you are or what you're going through. Everybody's story is relevant, whether it's complicated or simple, because pain is pain. Whether it's a death or a divorce or an illness, or whatever. And I've just kind of embodied that into my life. And I'm in a very healthy place now, but not to say that I was at a different time in my life. So to kind of kick that off, and this is going to date myself. So I'll start with back in the late 1990s, I was heavily involved in the tech industry, IPOs, you know, that crazy time when everything was going nuts on Wall Street and everything was a launch and this and that. And I was the only woman in a all-male environment. And it was cutthroat. It was heavy duty. It was a lot of fun, hard play, hard work. We all remember that time. And this one IPO I worked for after it went public became very toxic, misogynistic, sexist. Very unhealthy environment for a lot of women who worked there. And there were lawsuits. And I just kind of said, you know, I'm going to take what shares I had. I wasn't fully vested in. I'm going to back away from this. So I took my shares and I started my own business. It was my first business. And it was an upscale children's boutique because I loved working with kids. And I became heavily involved in the community. And I worked with local hospitals and did fashion shows, you know, for charity and a lot of the churches. And got to know a lot of the moms in the community and the teachers, the high school. And the teachers at the high school said, you know, we know your background. We know you're professional, what you've done. You know, would you want to speak to the girls in the high school about women in business, glass ceiling, entrepreneurship? I said, absolutely. I would love to do that. And I did. And one class turned into two and two turned into three. And then it was an auditorium. And the engagement from these girls, you know, just to see their excitement and the questions they had was so heartwarming to me, to know that if they could just take it and go and see more women in business, it just was so wonderful. So that was part of what I was doing. And that kind of sparked me up to speaking on a personal level, because I'd always done corporate speak, but it was never personal. So meanwhile, I'm running my business and I'm Italian. I live in New Jersey, go figure. So the community that my business sat in, lo and behold, my adjacent businesses was an Italian restaurateur, an Italian salon, an Italian shoe guy. This could never happen anywhere else. So we're all Italian. So every morning we'd have our coffee clutch, eat our pastries. We knew each other, our families, our lives, our stories. And it was a fantastic time. It was like, you know, that evil of corporate, you're away from that. And it was that soul suckingness. And it was just like joy to run your own business and to work with people that were nice and cared about you and whatever. Well, the Italian restaurateur, who was a widower of some young, beautiful girls, He was always kind of sniffing around, and I was like, no, we're not doing this. You know, he always did it privately and always asked me, we should go out to dinner, just the two of us. And I'm like, no, it's okay. Thank you. But finally he just kept doing it. And he's like, so, you know, when are we going to do this? I'm like, okay, we'll go out. So he picks me up, we go out, and then I immediately realized this is a date. This is not a business dinner. And I had been like, I'm going to tell him that this is a friendship, this is a business dinner, this is going no further than this, absolutely not. Well, turned out to be the best date of my life. And I remember coming home, I'm walking into my kitchen and walking up to the sink that overlooked like the window that looked outside. And I said to myself, oh, crap. Because I knew I was toast. He'd known it for months. You know, I never believed in this, you know, soulmates crap. That wasn't me. I was like, no, I'm the tough chick and I'm not doing this. So lo and behold, 1 year later, whirlwind romance swept, you know, sweep me on my feet. And, you know, kids are calling me mom, I'm a soccer mom, we're running our businesses, we're engaged, everything's fantastic. And we go on an engagement vacation trip to Aruba. Absolutely beautiful. And it was July 4th, 2002. And he had a massive heart attack and died in my arms while I was trying to resuscitate him. And I will never forget the sights, the smells of everything around me. I was in this beautiful open-aired lobby of the hotel, which looked out over the pool, which looked out over the ocean. I was watching the sunrise come up. And I just kept thinking about this inevitable phone call I was going to have to make to his family. And then I'm thinking, oh my God, the girls. Because the will hadn't been changed. I couldn't take them. I had no legal rights. And when I came back, it was a nightmare. The kids were scattered about all to different family members. They wanted to come with me. They couldn't. I tried to stay in their lives for about 2 years or so, but I could see what it was doing to them. I was like a constant reminder of what they couldn't have. You know, they had no mother, no father, and now they're with all these different parts of their family that weren't equipped to give them the structure of the life that they needed. And it broke my heart years and years later that the little one, the youngest, who was 10 at the time, wound up being a heroin addict and was in and out of rehab twice. And I remember hearing that from someone in the grocery store just 3 or 4 years ago. And I just drove home in tears because I just, not to say that bad things may not have happened if we'd been together, but I know for a fact that the structure that we had in place was so strong that because they were this aunt or this cousins, or that they were just constantly in different places, and it was not good for them. But I had to let them go because I saw what it was doing to them, and it broke my heart. But I had to think of them first, so I kind of let them go, and I kept running my business. But after a few years, being in such close proximity with his still, you know, a couple doors down, it was just too much. It was like a constant reminder for me. So I sold my business, took some time off, and, you know, tried to regroup as best I could, because I wasn't, there was no real grieving time for me. You know, because I was trying to run a business, and I was trying to take care of the kids as best I could. But I will say this, when it happened, and, you know, a lot of friends and family did not like the way that I handled it, but I knew it was what I had to do for me. I said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a year, and I'm not going to celebrate any holiday. I'm not going to leave my house. I'm going to stay home for a year. And I'm going to, you know, every holiday, I'm going to remember the one that I had with him and those girls for a year. And I'm not going to go out. I don't want to go out to dinner. I don't want to go out for cocktails. I want to go to work and I want to come home. So that was my rhythm for a year after this happened, after I was able to let the girls go before, you know, closing down the business and all that. I went, you know, I'd wake up, I'd cry, I'd go to work, I'd come home, I eat dinner, I'd cry. And there had to have been countless nights that I literally just spent on my tile floor in my kitchen, just sobbing until I passed out, because it sounds awful, but I knew in here that that is what I had to do for me. I had to force myself to remember. I had to force myself to go through every memory, every Christmas, every birthday, every little piece I had left of him. And at the end of that year, was it another July 4th, some amazing friends took me out. They said, okay, it's a year now. We haven't bothered you for a year. We waited for you. Now I talk to you on the phone every now and then, but you're going out to a club. You're going out dancing with us. And a whole bunch of my guy friends, love them to death, took me to, all my boys came, and they got me vamped up at a salon, and we went out dancing, and it was just like this release. Like, it was like after a year, it was like, oh, you know, like I felt like I could actually breathe again, you know. But it wasn't the end of it. I mean, I knew I still had an uphill battle, because I had also lost my faith. I'm Roman Catholic. I was raised Italian, Episcopal now. I converted. But I didn't pray for a year, maybe 2 years. I didn't believe in anything. And that took a long time to get back. I'm really strong now spiritually and with my church and stuff. But back then was, what was I going to pray for? These kids are orphans. He's dead. I'm alone. Everything was crap. So that wasn't even an option. But going back to what I said before was, you know, I sold that business after all this stuff, took some time off, and within 6 months got completely bored out of my mind because I'm a workaholic, and began working for this company that I currently work for now. I have my own businesses, but I also have a company that I work for. And I remember when I interviewed for the position, the guy looked like Lex Luthor, but he wasn't evil. He just looked like that, just to kind of give you a visual perception. And, you know, a couple months go by, the people there are so cool. Again, most of them Italian. I don't know how I keep finding myself in this situation. The owner was a divorcee, had two older boys, whatever. And he was like, oh, let's go to lunch, or let's go for coffee. And I'm like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. This is not happening again. I'm like, stop crapping where you eat. Well, fast forward 4 years, and we're engaged. We're extraordinarily happy, you know, just getting ready to plan our life together. And I get a phone call from my then-to-be brother-in-law, and he says, I have something to tell you. I'm like, what's up? He's like, he died in bed with another woman today. And I was like, you can't be serious. And all my friends at the time were like, well, you know, Nick, at least it wasn't you this time. And I'm like, well, hey, okay, there's a silver lining there, you know. But it was a mess. I mean, the funeral was the ex-wife, the mistress, and me. And I just stayed in like the back room because I wanted no part of all this drama going on. I wanted to pay my respects. I wasn't going to be this crazy person. That's not my style. But the business was in his name, but all the bank accounts and everything were in both of our names. So I was the one handling all the back end and finances. So how is this company going to stay running? I have all these people who need health insurance. I mean, these people need to keep their jobs. And he was in the process of selling the company to the current owner, who was an employee at the time, who was able to eventually buy the company. But it took like a year. So in the interim, he's kind of trying to handle that. And I'm just, you know, we're just running things like normal with me signing checks just to make sure everybody, no one loses their health insurance. Everybody keeps their job. That was the main goal. You know, there was no time, just like with Joe, there was no time for me. It was like everybody else had to, there was too many other important things that needed to be taken care of. So year goes by, he gets the business. I'm like, whew, okay, breather. So now I'm at the point where, okay, I need a vacation. I think I need a real vacation. And I always used to travel alone. I loved it, traveling the Caribbean. I always met amazing people, had a fun time, you know. So I took this trip to the Bahamas. And, you know, it's kind of like one of those Apple type vacations, you know, where it's a 747, but it's not like a United plane. It's like one of those kind of things. Fantastic vacation. I was rejuvenated, happy. I was coming back. I'm like, oh, I really needed this. So we take off. It's a late night flight coming home. About 15 minutes into the flight, the, you know, Mr. Captain America, Mr. Bright White Smile, you can tell, you know, comes on and he says, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we need to make an emergency landing in West Palm. I'm like, okay, great. Nobody's going to make their connecting flight, you know, collective sigh on the plane. But then one of the stewardesses completely loses her shit and starts screaming on the plane. And now all the other flight attendants are trying to calm her down. That's when we kind of knew something was a little more off than perhaps they had initially let us onto. So then the captain comes back on and he says, ladies and gentlemen, please prepare for a crash landing. You know, put your head between your legs, masks will drop, you know, brace, that whole thing. And apparently the landing gear, something happened where it never completely went up and it was stuck, and like some kind of hydraulic fluid or something was leaking from the plane because the plane had like a shutter to it. So we're like, okay, here we go. And I'm just, you know, like, really, I just wanted a vacation. So about, I don't know, 4 or 5 rows up and to my left was this quintessential stereotypical Italian old woman, you know, with brown-eyed helmet head, orthopedic shoes, the gold jewelry, the big fuzzy sweater, even though it's 90 degrees out, and you know someplace in that fuzzy sweater, she has got a candy covered in lint. She's going to try and offer it to you like 20 minutes later. So she's sitting there, she's doing her rosary and stuff, and I'm looking at her going, we're not going down. Nobody's dying on this plane, not with her on this plane. So we see the runway, and, you know, emergency vehicles, whatever, fire trucks. And we hit, and because the landing gear was wonky, we didn't hit normal. So it kind of started going sideways. So we could feel that it was trying to stop, and it was trying to keep it. And eventually we did stop, and everybody was okay. And that was, we were all like, oh, you know. So I only do carry-on. So I grabbed my bag. We all deboard the plane. Now, this is West Palm, which is a smaller airport, and this is like midnight now. And there's no commissaries open. It's a dead zone. So we're all sitting there for hours. And they come back to us, and they say, ladies and gentlemen, we fixed the problem. Everyone can reboard the plane. Well, when I say, and I'm not going to let the F-bomb drop, but I will just say this, in unison, everyone said, are you bleeping kidding me? And a riot breaks out. The sheriff's department gets called. I'm backing myself up against the back wall, like, I'm not getting into any of this. And I call my Aunt Antoinette from Brooklyn, who I knew lived like 20 minutes away. And then her, you know, Italian Brooklyn accent, she's like, we're coming to get you, me and Uncle John, we're going to be there. Don't you dare get on that plane. I'm like, okay. So they come and get me, get my stuff, go to their house, have an extended vacation, which was lovely, take a different airline home. And that was how I detoxed after how many years of all this stuff happening. So that was my, you know, oh, this is great. My great downtime. And it was nuts. It was just so nuts. So now we're going to fast forward a couple more years. And I had been having these, it was like maybe just one weekend. I had been having these weird sensations in my legs, like stiffness, numbness. Like, you know, when you overdo it with yard work and stuff, which is exactly what I'd done. I had been like doing so much too much, and I knew I'd overdone it. So. I talked it up to that. I'm driving to work one day on the interstate. If anybody's familiar with the New Jersey Turnpike or New York Thruway or, you know, Washington or Baltimore, anywhere in the country, California, you know what the major interstates are like. So I'm on that, and I'm on my way to work in the morning. And this is just 2 days after I started the initial sensations. And all of a sudden, I started to feel the stiffness intensify and creep up my legs and my abdomen, and a banding feeling come across my chest, weakening my hands and constricting my breathing. And it was scary as hell. I mean, I had to pull over to rest stop. Now, being the bullheaded, strong-willed Italian woman I am, I collected myself and drove through it straight to the doctor. Blood test, x-rays, still no answer. Have this family friend, incredible neurologist. He was a short, hunchback man with like a hawk-like nose. He was barely 5 feet. Suspenders, bow tie, orthopedic shoes. He was reminiscent of a cartoon character. Absolutely freaking adorable. But he had the bedside manner of House. And I'm sure you and many other people remember that TV show. So after a battery of MRIs, I go in to see him. And he also, on top of all this going on, his nasally voice was kind of like the nanny with Fran Drescher. So he was like just a joy to talk to. So I go and I see him, and he says to me, "Monica, you have MS. I want you to see this doctor. Blah, 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 blah." And it was like after MS, that was all I heard. Everything after that was kind of like the peanut. Remember the Peanuts cartoon when the adults talked? All you heard was wah, 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 wah. That's all I heard in my brain. Because after the way he said it, you know, was like he might as well have said it with, "Oh, Nicole, you have MS. You want a cookie?" That's kind of how it was presented to me, you know, in this weird way. So I'm just sitting there and I'm going, seriously? You have got to be kidding me. But the thing was, I knew if I could make it through Joe, I could do this. Joe was the first fiance that died. And it was kind of like, all right, I'm gearing up for this fight. Because when I get pissed off, I get picked up. That it just kind of started that way. It started to build. So the unfortunate part was within a couple more days, it had really kind of taken over, and I was partially paralyzed from the waist down. I couldn't walk. I couldn't drive. I couldn't hold a cup. I couldn't climb stairs. At the time, I had like an architectural three-story house with a lot of stairs, and I lived alone. So I had to like crawl up on my hands and knees, and I bounced down on my behind when I wanted to come down. And it was just a lot of pain. And you know, I had kickboxed for years, so I was used to pain, but this is different. This wasn't like getting a punch in the face. This is just like constant 24-hour. I can't lift my finger. I can't hold my spoon. I can't do anything. And it was extraordinarily frustrating. And 6 months of physical therapy, and I was, you know, able to regain the ability to function like before. But little did I know that wouldn't last, because 4 years later, Easter 2010, it happened again. This time the damage was partially permanent from the waist down. No one can tell I have MS, and it's not like I'm trying to hide it. I just choose to not be that person. Like when you see me walking, because I work out a lot now. I used to wear stilettos, now I wear kitten heels. You know, I've altered my life. I've made adjustments. You know, I can't kickbox anymore. I can still hit the bag with a person's face on it if I'm really pissed off that day. The second time around was harder. It was harder to come back from. It was more painful because I knew the damage was going to be permanent. Having the 24/7 pain in my legs, or not being able to feel my feet, or just all these things. You know, and then there was the intimacy factor too. You know, would I ever be able to be intimate with my partner? Because I couldn't feel anything at all at the time. This was before things got better. So all these horrible things were just going through my head. And that's what, you know, I still lived alone at the time. I was seeing somebody who is now, God bless him, my husband. That's a whole other story. But it, that was the time when I started to pray for God to just take me in my sleep. Like, I was done. It was like the cumulative toll of everything that had happened had just become too much. And the fact that I had all these painkillers around me constantly, like, I could have just grabbed a pill bottle at any given night and been done. I would have been out, down for the count, never see me again. Somebody take care of the will, here you go. But me being the hardcore animal lover that I am, I would look on one side and see the pup, just look on the other side, see the cat, and go, oh, well, who's going to take them out in the morning? And being an only child, now I have my mom, I have my dad, I have my family, and I knew it would destroy them. So it was always that thing in the back of my brain of, I can't, because I can't leave them. I can't do that to them. If I had not had, you know, that, who knows what would have happened, but I had that for me, that was like, I feel I'm always taking care of everybody. So that was my responsibility to never let them hurt or feel pain, or my little furry babies or whatever. But that was the worst time that I could ever think that I would ever want to do that. And the fact that it was just, I mean, I still have my pain medications that I take, but the thought never crosses my mind. But it was just that time that was so dark, because I couldn't walk, and I knew the damage, some of the damage was permanent. It made for a very dark, difficult, unexpected place that I never in my life would have thought that I would have found myself in. And, you know, sometimes when you talk to other people, they say the same thing. I would never have thought I would have found myself feeling that way in that place at that time. And all it would have taken was just that one flip of the switch, and I would have just been in a different direction. Mm-hmm. But yeah, once I got through that part, and the physical therapy and started to regain my ability to function again, that's really when the lights went on. That's when everything just, like, you know what? Screw this. Anyone who's toxic in my life, out. Anyone who is a naysayer, out. It's hard to do with family, but anybody else, out. I mean, I hate to be harsh or cruel, but this has got to be a number one priority. If you're going to come to me and go, oh, really? No, you can't do that. No, because somebody telling me I can't do something is like the best thing you could ever say to me, because it's going to make me want to do it more. You know, I've been like that since I was a kid. And that's when I just got rid of all the junk and all the naysayers and all the people who were just like sucking every ounce of life out of me. And I didn't have much left at the time. You know, I wanted to be lifted up. I didn't need people who were going to be like, put me in martyrdom or something, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's when the shift happened. And I've always been a healthy eater, and I've always worked out, but I like doubled down on everything. And I changed my diet completely, read up on all the books of what you should and shouldn't eat. And it's different for everybody. Everybody's got a different DNA system. Found what worked for me, stuck to it. Work out, you know, almost every morning for, you know, good 30 to 45 minutes. I walk, I bicycle, I swim, you know, whatever. And lots of yoga. Still hit the bag every now and then, which is fun. But it was just that matter of changing, realizing that you can change. It's never too late to just change your life in a totally different direction. And that's when I started working with the MS Society. I started volunteering. I wanted to do more, to be, again, be part of something bigger than myself. And I have a legal background. So they said, well, you want to do legislative work? I said, sure. You know, so now I meet with Congress and Senate, and I go to the State House, and we work to get bills passed for people with MS, ALS, Parkinson's, medications, you know, patient advocacy groups, patients' rights, healthcare rights. And it's very rewarding. And MS Society, you know, I've got amazing friends there. And they said to me, like, Nicole, you should talk to your pharma company. I said, why? And I said, well, because they like to get people like you who have a story to tell, or a background, and they will send you, you become a speaker for them. I'm like, okay, yeah, well, who do you talk to? Like, well, you talk to patients and you talk to nurses and doctors and sales reps and sometimes CEOs and, you know, just all different avenues of life. I'm like, all right, I can do that. So I reached out and it was kind of like a whirlwind. The next thing I know, I was vetted, then media trained, and then now I'm traveling around the country and I'm speaking to patients and advocacy groups and CEOs and sales reps and doctors and nurses. And when I talk to patients, it's a very different thing because it's very personal. It's, you know, I've been in your shoes. I totally get it. You know, I've had people just start crying because they needed to get out of their system. I'll sit and hold their hand for 15 minutes if they want, whatever you need. I'm here for you. You want to get it out because you have to get it out. You need to. Or if I can make you laugh for 5 minutes out of a real crappy day, then I feel like my purpose on this earth has been served for today. More than one person, then hey, you know, even better. But, and when I talk to the sales reps and the doctors and the nurses, for them, it's a reminder, you know, people aren't just a number on a file. They're not just a name on a file. There's a person behind that file. And if you can make just the simplest reference, make an extra phone call on their behalf if they need something, you know, or if the patient's having a problem and they can't get a medication or they need a referral, they need it, just pick up that phone call, just one person one day, and just make that call, because you have to understand that that phone call is going to make somebody's day or could potentially change their life. And I tell the sales reps the same thing. I said, when you're sitting in that doctor's office, you know, waiting for your turn to meet with the doctor so you can give them samples or whatever, just strike up a conversation with one of the patients in the office, just on a personal level, nothing professional, and just talk to them for a minute. So you can be reminded of why you're doing what you're doing. You're not just making a living. You're not just selling a drug. Yeah, that's all well and good. But that person sitting next to you, you could be saving their life, you know? And it just kind of morphed into this thing. You know, now the pharma company started recommending me and a couple other people to marketing groups that, you know, kind of do the same thing, but on a different scale. And like I did a corporate retreat back in February. That was a lot of fun. Tough crowd. Sometimes farmers are really tough crowd, but I'm a very upbeat person and I'm huge into Motown. As far as I'm concerned, if you don't like Motown and you can't get up and move to it, there's something wrong with you. So one of my speeches is called 25 Miles. And I always play this song by Edwin Starr, 25 Miles. And they're up. I don't care who you are. I will walk to your table and I will get you up and you will be dancing and you will be moving. So I have this thing that I call the three E's: entertain, engage, and educate. Because no matter who the group is, whether it's corporate or sales, or my favorite is when I'm talking to patient advocates or women's groups. Women's groups are phenomenal to talk to. Or even when I do church groups, even the kids too, about, you know, adversity and not judging others, because you never know what's going on behind closed doors. You have to entertain, because if you can entertain, then you're going to engage them. And once they're engaged, that's when you have their attention and you can educate them on what really needs to be said. Otherwise, they're just going to hit the snooze button and be like, the whole time that they're there. And we've all been there. We've all sat in those kind of presentations and sales meetings and whatever. And we're like, oh my gosh, when am I going to get my free donuts and coffee? I can't sit here anymore. And I never want to be that person. I want to be the person that's going to make them laugh and listen and kind of just wake up and have that aha moment, whatever it is. But I can honestly say with 100% certainty, I get more joy out of talking to people than they could ever possibly get from listening to me, because I am so honored and humbled and just so grateful just to be there, just to be able to help anybody, that I swear I go home and I'm like floating. I'm just like, oh, you know, it was just so nice just to talk to people and meet all these incredible people. And I make sure, whether it's a room of 550 or 150, that I will meet every single person in that room, because I want to have a personal connection with them, whether they like me or not, whether they take anything away or not. I just want to be able to just meet you and say hi, or maybe hear your story if you're willing to talk or whatever. But to me, that was when it came. I hate that term full circle, but it kind of came to that point of where the adversity became the empowerment, and not just for myself, but being able to give that to somebody else who maybe didn't have it. Or, you know, there have been times when, you know, everybody's, well, how do you tell a story without crying? I said, well, a couple things. First, I have not cried in 16 years in public, not since Joe's funeral. It's just something I don't do. I will never do it again, period. My husband has never even seen me cry. I cry in my shower. It's just a personal thing. Can't explain it. It's just not something I do. That's the first thing. Because I thought I was all cried out back then, but, you know, allotted only a certain amount of tears. But that's not true either. And the second thing was, it's cathartic for me. Every time I tell it, you don't understand. You're giving me something back just by listening, because I'm getting a tiny little piece of myself back every time I'm able to tell that story and know that it could potentially be helping one person heal, one person reach out to a support group, one person reach out to a family member or a friend that could help them. Or maybe they know somebody who needs a friend or a hand, and maybe they can be that person. So it's, and plus telling it so many times, you kind of, you get to the point where you don't need to cry anymore. But I just joy, just pure joy, and just knowing that I could take all this junk and turn it into something positive.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. So, it's nothing less than an amazing story. Absolutely, some very traumatic times for you. And for our listeners, what are some of the things that you look back on and think, I wish I had done this differently? Or was there a point in time where you beat yourself up or that you questioned yourself? Talk through that a little bit, because I know when you and I had spoken at one point that you felt very guilty for a period of time with the loss of your first fiance.
Yeah.
Talk through that if you could.
When Joe died, and we were lying in bed and we were asleep. And he woke me up kind of going like this, kind of, I felt this, and I'm like, what's the matter? And he was gurgling, like, I'm like, what is he doing? And then I turned the light on and I saw his face, and that's when I realized, oh my God, he's having a heart attack. Pulled him off the bed, because I knew CPR from the years of kickboxing. You have to be trained in CPR as an instructor. So pulled him off the bed and got him on the ground. And I started CPR. And I had the phone here. But the problem was I couldn't do both at the same time. So I had to like hold on to the phone and be like, you got to get up here. And I always think to myself, every now and then it creeps into my head now, but back then, for years and years, if I had just started CPR a few seconds earlier, would he still be here? That it was my fault that those girls were orphans, that they were alone, that they were left in this life, bounced around to family members, that the youngest became a heroin addict, that all these things, and it was all my fault, you know, and I had the hardest time forgiving myself for that. I think that was part of why I felt I had to relive every single second I ever had with him that year that I took, to relive every holiday, every memory, every dinner we went to, every joke that we laughed at, every walk that we went for, every intimate moment, because I just had to relive these things in my brain, because I just completely felt consumed that it was my fault. And my close friends were always like, it's not your fault. There was nothing you could have done. And this is something that I've never shared with anyone verbally like this in this environment. When they came up and the EMTs were, doing their thing, and I was looking at them and I was telling you, don't go. The girls need you. I need you. Just, you're talking, you're trying to look in their eyes, you're trying to keep them there. And I was leaning over him and, his legs were partially spread and I had my hand on the floor, like in between his legs, kind of near his crotch area. And all of a sudden I felt everything was wet. And that's when I knew he was gone, because you lose your fluids. I had been around other members of my family who passed, and I know that that's what happens. But they kept working on it for half an hour, and they charged him again and again and again and again. They did it probably for 20 or 30 minutes, even at the hospital, trying to bring him back, because it can happen. It's happened before. But I knew in my heart the second that I felt that in my hand that he was gone. And the look in his eyes was just like this fear. Like, I don't want to go. I don't want to leave. I can't stop this. You could see it in his face. Like he didn't want to go. And that's that vision that stuck with me. And that sensation of my hand being wet and realizing that I was the one who let these girls become orphans. That was the hardest thing I ever had to live through. Constantly.
How did you work through that guilt? How did you get past that? And I know you talk about, taking that year and reliving through every moment, but how did you give yourself the opportunity to forgive you, even though it wasn't your fault? How did you get past that?
That was hard because, I had thought about doing therapy. And I had, when I was in my youth, I did it once and I was like, this isn't for me. Cause I know therapy is fantastic for a lot of people and you have to have the right therapist and it has to be this, like all the stars have to align for it to truly be what it's supposed to be. Support group wasn't for me at that time. That just was not. I think I started to really pull from my grandmother. My mother's mother, she was Polish. She was end of World War II. She was dark haired, dark complexion. At the very end of the war, they were throwing a lot of Polish people into concentration camps who did not look the right way, that they did not want around. And she was one of them. And she lived off of raw potatoes for 6 months, surviving any way she could. And I grew up with her in the same house. Like we grew up in a very big house with my mom, my dad, my aunt, my mom's sister, and my grandparents. So I was surrounded by all these strong women, but I always thought back to her. I'm like, she lived through that. Look what she did. I mean, for 6 months, and that's only the parts that I knew that she lived through. I don't know what other atrocities she went through. One of the American GIs happened to be the person who liberated the camp, who married my grandmother. Cute little romantic story. But I constantly thought of her because I couldn't think of God at the time. So she was my source of inspiration. And I talked to her at night, you know, I'd be like, she was Polish, the Polish word for bocce. His grandmother's bocce. I was like, bocce, you know, I got to talk to you. And I would talk to her instead. And she was like super religious growing up. So I'm like, well, maybe she'll be my conduit. She'll be like my red backbone to God or something. I don't know. But that was one of the things I did. And a lot of hysterical crying. The catharsis of part of the guilt was just constant crying. I mean, I know that probably wasn't the best way to go for a lot of people. Maybe it even wasn't for me at the time. But I just found that, you know, that for me, that being alone and that constant reflection and spending time with my dog. I mean, I still talk to my friends on the phone, but I would not go out. I still talk to my family, but I would not go out. And it just, it was just like a rhythm. It was a daily rhythm that I would talk to her at night before I went to bed. And I would remind myself, yeah, I just went through this, but she went through that. You know, this is horrific, but that was pretty bad too. And look how she turned out. So that was a huge source of inspiration for me personally. And I didn't want to be that way forever. I didn't want to be one of those people that I saw and what they turned out like if they let that eat at them like a canker sore. That's not how I wanted to spend the rest of my life. So I knew I had to find a way. And my way was talking to her, a lot of crying, and a lot of intense self-reflection and hardcore romance movies that you knew you were going to cry, but you need to just watch them anyway, just as an added bonus to cry anyway. I will never forget. You know what movie came out right when that happened? If you've never seen the movie Return to Me with David Duchovny and Minnie Driver, that movie came out at that moment when the wife died. I'm like, oh, you know, this is perfect. This is not what I needed to see right now. But that movie was out at the time. But yeah, that's how I remember dealing with that. It was just really using her.
Gotcha. So today, where you are today, you obviously have come through this. And to your point, you talk about coming back kind of full circle and adversity to empowerment. So do you go through anything on a day-to-day basis? Are you feeling 100%? Where are you emotionally now?
Well, emotionally and physically tie together for me because I do have MS.
Right.
So that's a constant yin and yang battle because I work a lot and I'm constantly pushing myself, probably more than I should. But, you know, I don't meditate like I used to. I used to do much better with the meditation, and I really need to get back to that. But the yoga is tremendous. Like, my daily routine usually consists of I get up, I'll work out, do my yoga, get ready for work, have my breakfast, you know, the dog, the family, go to work. Come home, work on my own business stuff. And I'll usually try to get in a little stretching and stuff before I go to bed because I tend to find that that makes me feel better to help me sleep because of the pain levels. But because the emotional and the physical go hand in hand, it's like if I overdo it and I don't get sleep, then emotionally I kind of turn into a bit of a vegetable. My mind is not in a good place. So everyone's like, oh, life work balance. I'm like, excuse my language, bullshit. That does not exist.
Right.
That does not exist. What does exist is the balance within you. Mm-hmm. And there is this great quote from Eat, Pray, Love when she says, you don't find God, you know, in a church, in an ashram, in a this or that. God is within you, God dwells as you. And it's funny, my Reverend Karen has a sign over her door in her office, and it's, and I'll, this cracks me up every time I see her, and it says, "Don't worry, God is always listening. She can hear you." And every time I see that, I'm like, you know, this is why I love you. It's just having that open mind to anything. Life is a journey. I'm along for the ride. I don't know where I'm going. I know where I want to go. I don't know where I'm going to get or how I'm going to get there, but I'm going to keep plugging away, and I'm going to do it in a healthy way, because I don't think those things anymore, because I realize there's too many good things in this life. There's too many good people in this life. And I know a lot of people don't have that, which is hard, and it's really sad. And I meet them a lot. You know, you probably do too with your programs. And just trying to give them that extra, can't think of the word, just that extra
support,
that extra push, that extra, you know, that's why I say, here's my phone number. If you don't have any, like, well, we don't really have anybody that I can talk to about this stuff. I hear that a lot when I talk. Or, you know, I may not be as strong as you, or I may not be as this or whatever. And I said, well, you know what? Here's my phone number. When you feel that way, you call me, and I will tell you you can. I will tell you you're good enough. Or here's my email. You just let me know. Because you are that strong. You are that worthy. And you deserve to be freaking happy. We all do. You know, we all deserve to let our freak flag fly and just be happy. You know, life is short, man. It can turn on a dime. Everything that you once knew can be turned upside down.
Right.
But those were the lessons that taught me that every second counts. You know, being present in every moment, like this amazing one, you know, we're in right now talking to each other, because it's the good and the bad that allow for strength and resilience and passion for life to shine through. I mean, hey, this isn't a practice life. You know, I decided to turn my devastation into determination for a reason, because I wanted to be able to help other people who are in the same boat for whatever reason. Pain is pain, man. Pain is pain.
Yeah, that it is. That it is. So I want to thank you. Thank you very much. For being here, for being you, for sharing your story, and bearing your soul. So I appreciate you. I'm glad that you could join us.
Thank you so much. All my love always.
Absolutely.